At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at AbilityChiro.com.
CODA salutes those who've served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 14th of August, 2020. On the podcast today, Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about the best and worst performing stock markets since the start of the year. Also on the podcast, Paul Hill, full-time investor and equity analyst, talks about the following companies: Clearstar, Lloyds, Taylor Wimpey, Aviva, Northbridge Industrial Services, Roslyn Data Technologies, Alico, Tristel, On the Market, Blanco Technology, Inspiration Healthcare, Interseed Group, and Instem. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk. We all see lots of other content. There's articles on Verona, Horizonte, Touchstone, Europe Metals, and also right there you can see our COVID-19 index. Biggest riser on that index today is 4D Pharma, up 12% to 92 or 93 pence. Biggest faller today is Modern Water, down 7.6%, 2.125. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
I'm very well. I'm in good health, Justin. How are you?
Yes, I'm very good. I'm glad it's cooled down a bit, the heat.
Brighton, it's been like a furnace down here. I don't know what it's been like where you are, but it is. I'm looking out of my office window, and there's a bit of a breeze coming in for the first time, and it's a bit sticky and a bit close, but it's grey, and it's about 10 degrees cooler than it's been for most of the last week.
Yeah. Part of me thinking now, where's the sun gone? But I was whinging about the heat and humidity for days.
There you go. So,
So you're still down working from home. I just wondered, you know, because I read a report saying, in fact, a friend of mine also said he went to Pret-a-Manger in the city of London recently. He said literally they've got two staff for every customer, and they said themselves, the company, there's not enough demand as yet. There's still a lot of offices empty. So what's the state of play with your company?
With AJ Bell, the Manchester head office has been slowly populating since early July. I don't know the exact percentage, but I'm led to believe, I don't know, it's probably something like a quarter or a third, and he's building all the time. We've always had people in, IT backup, some key customer services, for obvious reasons, because we're, you know, a customer-facing business, but equally we're an online platform, and a lot of the processes that are currently being done in the office, we're looking at ways of making sure that they can be done remotely and above all securely at the same time. London, there are a select number of people in there. There's capacity for 80 in the London office. There's a plan being sent round for return to work, and it looks like from mid-September, we will be encouraged to go back to London. You know, obviously commuting and other things have got to be sorted out, but the office is ready for people to return. We'll be doing it on a rota basis initially, I believe, so we won't be going straight back to 80. We'll be doing it on a sort of percentage rota basis. So my plan is to go initially back 2 days a week. And just so I can see some different walls, which would be quite nice. And just dip my toe in and see how it goes, and then we'll take it from there. But that's then fitting in with it, because I work on a team of six people, and that's fitting in with the rota that we'll be running for that team. And some of that team live in London, and some don't, so we're sort of moving it around to help.
Yeah, because did you see this gradual move back? And I think that's the way, apart from the stock market, which, you know, in some cases rebounded, of course. But I mean, it's
stock markets don't do anything gradually or very rarely.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we all realise that it's a gradual, like that night tick, really. It'll bottom out.
Yeah.
And then gradually, like, I was looking at Greg's results, and obviously the first 3 months of the year, the half-year results, they were pretty much normal, of course, and then they had nothing, pretty much. And then, so I think their revenue went down, the first half of this year, it went down from 546 million to 300 million. And so, and I can't see it improving quickly now, because, you know, like you say, everyone's going gradually back to work. Yes, they have out-of-town sort of stores and service stations and stuff, but a lot of them are sort of centrally located in cities and towns.
Yeah,
and,
I think that's the key thing. Talking to my friends who work in retail and contacting retail particularly, what I'm hearing from them is that the physical stores in sort of more provincial or regional towns and decent sized cities are actually doing okay.
Yeah.
Anything that's in a shopping mall or in a major out of town shopping area or in central London or in a department store, not good at all.
Yeah.
So there's a clear difference. Obviously, in London, you haven't got the tourists, you haven't got the office, you haven't got the workers in there. People seem a lot more reluctant to travel, even though I understand from the numbers for what they're worth that there's relatively limited incidence of COVID at the moment in central London, and long may that stay the case. Mm-hmm. But yeah, anything to do with going into a big department store where there are potentially crowds, people are still fighting shy, happy to walk around their own town and, you know, walk in or whatever, or maybe short hop in the car or something and have a potter around. And I guess it's going to be interesting to see whether the eat out for a, you know, get your tenner off scheme, whatever you think of the virtues of that, you know, financially and diet wise and everything, whether that just does give people confidence to mosey out. And certainly looking at when we went out for a long planned dinner on Wednesday night in central Brighton, there was definitely a lot of activity of that, there's no doubt.
Yeah.
If that gives people the confidence to mosey out a little bit more, and in the end, you know, if you've been out and exercised your opportunity to get your tenner and been out for dinner, then really, I'm not going to be too pleased if somebody's going to come and say to me, actually, I'm too frightened to go to work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I'm really not going to be too pleased about that at all.
No, exactly. If they're you know, eating out to help out and all that stuff, they're not coming to work. I know. Do you know what? We went out on Wednesday, into West Quay, which is Southampton, sort of big shopping centre. And I got to say that the restaurants were rammed; they were jam packed. People were queuing, and so it's nice to see. But you do think you're pretty spreading it. The thing is, my thought is this: I think the more we know about this this virus, we know pretty much if you're healthy, it's going to be largely not affect you that much. So part of the deal is maybe it's not a bad thing to pass it around a bit, you know, as long as you shield the people who need shielding.
I mean, that's the herd immunity theory that I think the government's been working on. It is very difficult. There's clearly the balance between physical health, financial health and mental health. Mm. But I think the way in which the numbers have been presented and or reported, where the focus has been on deaths, where the focus has been on just an absolute number increasing cases, you know, major outbreak in city X, and then you're looking at, he says number of cases up 110. You think, is that up 110 from zero? Is it up 110 from 6,000? Is it up 110 from 15,000? In which case, duh, statistically, it's a rounding error. Mm. Not that it's not nice for the people involved, but I think if the government really wants to give people confidence, I think it needs to. I think testing, tracing and tracking, I think, is really important. I think that does give people confidence. Mm. I think some people think masks give them confidence. Some people it puts them off. Yeah. I personally find walking around the street with people with their faces covered, like being something in a John Wyndham, dystopian John Wyndham novel, I actually don't find it very comfortable at all. And because human beings, you know, much of how you communicate is not just through your spoken word, but your face. And if you can't see half of it, I find that a bit disconcerting as a person who likes to talk and likes to interact and likes to communicate. So I'm not sure that, but I think the other thing that they need to do is say, look, these are the number of cases confirmed. These are the number of recoveries confirmed. And yes, very sadly, this is the number of deaths, and do it by age group, demographic, and you can then see where you fit. You can see what your chances are of recovery, and you can then see what, you know, the percentages are of something worse happening. And I would imagine, as you say, in most cases, unless you have a pre-existing health condition and unless you're of a certain age or possibly demographic, if you're pretty healthy, you're probably going to beat it. And I think that's what they need to be thinking about. If you really want to give confidence, you need to be focusing, actually, ladies and gentlemen, you're going to feel poorly for a few days, but then most of us, when we say we've got a bad cold, say we've got flu, well, we haven't really, because if you have got flu, you are wiped out. If you've got a bad cold, you feel terrible and you're breathing like a buffalo with an aqualung, but you're actually not got flu. So I think I'm not belittling the potential implications of the virus, but I'm saying the way in which the numbers have been presented and focused tends to accentuate the worst element of it. And actually that chips away at confidence.
And I think exactly.
Does that make sense?
Now I think that was all part. When we didn't know enough about it, it was the fear element to get people off the street and stop spreading it. And then now we know more about it, we think, hang on a second, it's not as bad as we actually thought. And so let's look at the bigger picture. You've been looking at what economies around the world have done better or worse.
And not surprisingly, it's a related topic. I mean, I've done the numbers over 10 years, 1 year, but I'm particularly focusing on the numbers since the 21st of February, which was when markets began, that Monday, the 24th of February, everything suddenly fell out of bed. There was that month of absolute stock market-wise carnage. So since then, if you look at UK, America, Japan, Western Europe, Latin America, Eastern Europe, emerging markets generally, and Asia, what would you say has been the best performing geographic region since the 21st of February? Most people would say America, right?
Yeah, maybe. I suspect it's Asia because they've been the first to get it and rebound.
Good. Top of the class. Asia Pacific ex Japan is up 2.6%. America's up 1%. And emerging markets broadly are flat, intriguingly, because of Asia, because it's such a big percentage of the index. I mean, Latin America is very weak because economically there are some basket cases there, and you've got heavy commodities exposure. And Eastern Europe, heavy commodities exposure, that's way down. Japan's down 5%. UK, down
18%. Wow.
Now, whether that's a comment on how the government has handled the thing, we were late into lockdown, we were late out, I suspect is a big percentage of that as well. But Asia is interesting for me because, you're right, it was first in, first out. I think that is a key consideration. I think you probably do have the majority of economies there are net importers of commodities rather than net exporters, so they've probably gained from things like weak oil rather than suffered. China, the stock market's been remarkably strong. It's actually holding above 3,000. Whether that's down to state interference or however you want to view it, the Chinese stock market has held up pretty strongly. The other thing that did occur to me was, well, let's not forget, Asia went through SARS in 2003. So they knew what was coming when they saw what was coming. Now, whatever you think of whether the Chinese told everybody up front or not, as soon as it got to places like Hong Kong and Korea, I know there's the odd outbreak now, but they dealt with it very quickly, very powerfully, and very stringently. And I suspect that for the last 17 years, they've been, that we've also had bird flu and things in the meantime, but I suspect for the last 17 years, they have been sitting on a policy response to a similar event. So my suspicion is that I know that there were all of those pre-COVID World Health Organization surveys on countries that were best placed to deal with the pandemic, and the UK and America were in the top 10. Discuss. But I think because the Asian countries have actually lived through it already, I think they were ready for it, and they knew exactly what they were doing. And that's why, yes, they were first in, but it's also why they were out pretty quickly. And I think that may be, again, one of the reasons why Asia has actually performed stronger this year. But intriguingly, it's actually hanging in very well over the last year as well. So it's not just a post-COVID thing. And I think that's partly because, again, they've underperformed. They're probably looking pretty cheap yield. Asia is actually surprisingly deep in terms of yield. You've got some interesting valuations there because of the underperformance. And also, if this, I know we've debated it before, this gathering narrative of are inflation expectations going up, because you've not just got monetary stimulus as you did 12 years ago, but you've got fiscal stimulus as well. And money has just been given to people and they have been told to go and spend it. And on the basis of what you saw in Southampton and I've seen in Brighton, there is an element of people are going out and spending it. And that's when you get not just supply of money going up, but velocity of money going up. And that's when you potentially get inflation, the Austrian definition of it at the very least, not just price increases.
Do you know what I find very odd is that the government are there trying to stimulate, the hospitality industry, especially the restaurant sector. And yet, And we know we were very late locking down at the start. I mean, and I think now they're trying to correct that and overdo it by, you know, saying you have to quarantine coming from France. But hang on, yeah. You're encouraging people to go out midweek in their droves in thousands in this country, and yet, if you look at the figures properly, there's a lot more chance of spreading it, surely, the thousands of people, you know, going restaurant, eating food, than there are just coming in from France. Or whatever. I mean, and some of these places they're coming in France probably have low cases. You know, they're just a blanket ban. It's a disconnect in the policy.
And if quarantine was important, then it begs the question, why wasn't it done in March?
Exactly. I looked at the stats.
That's what's confusing people.
I looked at the stats, and when it was announced by World Health Organization that it was a pandemic, and everyone knew by then, it was anyway, they all thought they were a bit behind the curve. We had 7 deaths in this country, that's all. And then literally we didn't do anything for another month, didn't lock down for another month. Well, hang on, surely that was the time. And then it went from 7 deaths to literally about 2,000 deaths within that month. And I thought, well, that was the time, and not now.
I think that's what's confused people. And I think you'll struggle to get people back to a full lockdown unless something truly awful happens, so fingers crossed. But I think local lockdowns, they will try and make those stick. They've got this difficult balancing act. They know that we all can't stay at home forever because the economy will just drop in a massive hole. And I guess that it sounds brutal, but in the end, if they want people to go back to work, then they have to look at the furlough scheme. Because if people are being paid to stay at home, then understandably, you know, economics is about incentive, right?
So if the incentive
is you're going to get relatively well looked after with your cost base, with your own personal outgoings having collapsed, for some people, the incentive to go out to work is not great. There are lots of people out there who just want to get back at it because of that sort of person, or just want to see 4 different walls, or see their mates, or whatever. And in the case of office, you know, one of the things that I think people are forgetting in terms of culture of companies, for senior people who can work at home, good broadband, nice laptop, maybe even a little home office, it's pretty straightforward. But if you and your outgoings have collapsed, you're having to buy a train season ticket or drive. But if you're an office junior, how do you learn? How do you network? Yeah. How do you know? And then for a senior manager, permeate, you know, getting the right culture of the firm, getting the young ones and the newbies to come in and buy into the culture, do things properly, is a lot harder. So there are potential long-term costs to a company. And so I think it is, you know, and that's why managers will be encouraging people to come back to work when they think it's appropriate, and people have got, you know, and it's clear that it's very safe to do so, even if it's gradual, because it's just important for the way in which companies are run, operate and provide the services and products that they're there to do. So I think it is really important. And I think, the government messaging, as you said, is not always clear, and it's not always helping people. As you say, actually, you go to France, then tough, but equally, we'd rather you sat in McDonald's surrounded by 150 people. It does seem that and of course, the other thing is, no disrespect to McDonald's, but, you know, it was rammed when we walked past it in Brighton on Wednesday evening. And given the Prime Minister 2 weeks ago had been talking about tackling junk food advertising and what people were eating, I thought that was a pretty interesting juxtaposition. Policies are a tricky thing, right? You know, there are always unintended consequences. Yeah. You know, maybe they were hoping that everyone would dash out to a salad bar, but no, that's not everybody's pocket goes that far, and everybody wants to eat that, you know. So it's very difficult. But it has struck me that Asia is doing well. It's been doing well for a bit. And again, if that inflation narrative gathers, Asia is rammed with high-quality cyclicals who are tuned into global growth and global trade patterns, and it would be a good way of playing it if that scenario pans out. So we'll see what happens.
Marvellous stuff, yeah. Cheers, Russ. Thanks for that.
It's great to talk to you again. Take care now.
I'll speak next week.
I look forward to it.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is equity analyst and full-time investor Paul Hill. You all right, fella?
Yeah, morning, Justin.
You've got so much enthusiasm, it wears me down. I'm enthusiastic and passionate, but your enthusiasm is exhausting. How does anyone live with you? Do you live on your own, or do you live with people?
Yeah, I am a slightly different character, I think, to a certain extent, at times anyway. But, big picture-wise, I just love stocks. I'm very passionate about it. I spend a lot of time in it. It's my hobby. Not my work, and I just really like trying to get my head around companies, sectors, and the economy, and putting all the pieces together, and trying to make views and seeing how that goes. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But it's like anything. Some people have passions, and this one is mine.
Yeah, no, I have a passion for it, definitely. And do you know what? I was thinking back, and I've often thought back to where my passion for stocks and shares started, and it was my A-level economics teacher. he just started like a fantasy league sort of stocks and shares thing. He said just it wasn't very fancy. He just said pick a stock, and we'll see how you do a couple of stocks, and you have pretend money. And since then, I've always been fascinated by it. And I think it's a pity we don't have it taught in schools. You know, investing. And so I remember going back to being taught, you know, long division or long multiplication, which I've never used in my life, or a little bit of trigonometry or angles of triangles. I don't need to know that. You know, I've never used that again in my life. Just teach me something I'll use in life. I will need to know about money. You know, and I'll probably want to do some investing if I get some spare money. So, you know, and you can change your sort of outlook and your fortune. You can make some money, you can build wealth in a sensible way. It doesn't have to be in other people's hands. You have to pay fund managers to do a job you could do pretty much. So I think it's so valuable. It's taught in schools, you know, but it's so many other things are taught that we never use. I think it's ridiculous. Anyway, let's first, I don't know what you talk about, but I just want to touch on ClearStar. I think they need to update more and more. I think they're a busy business there. They're doing very well. The last update was very positive in my mind. Of course, it's a hard market. It's, like I said, one of the biggest downturns we've ever had on history. In fact, probably the biggest downturn we'll ever have. And so, and they're in the jobs sector there. So it's been hard. But considering that trading update was very positive. And I think, you know, they should update about, I think any company with lots going on should update once a month. Not to ramp the company, just because the micro cap or the small cap investor is quite fickle, and unless you reassure them, they wee their pants and they say, "Oh, I'm going to sell. The share price has gone down a little bit. I'm selling." That's the way they are. I think, and so once a month is a general update. Would be quite nice, I think. You know,
I think you've just got to be patient in these sort of things, and you look at the actual, bigger picture wise, and the only reason why the shares are currently trading at the level of sort of like, 33, 34p is simply because there's been a long-term seller. And I think that seller is now out or there and thereabouts, and it doesn't need to disclose if I was right from last time, and I believe it's Artemis. I don't know, but I suspect it is. So on that basis, it's just been artificially pushed down. Now, in terms of go forward, as I mentioned last time, I think you just need to sort of like, investors just need to think about, we've had a trough in Q2. Q3 should be better than Q2, and then Q4 should be better than Q3. The only thing to say about that is the US presidential election. Now, if that actually throws a few rocks, political sort of like, scaremongering, then that may actually prove sentiment or damage sentiment in terms of the rehiring. So that's where I think the company is being rightly cautious. But if you then get through that, as in like, you think about next year and the year after next, if you have a relatively medium to long term time horizon, which I do as an investor, then there's no reason, in my view, this can't be a £1, £1.50 stock in 2 to 3 years time. And compared to only sort of like, say 33p, 34p, there's a significant return. So I think the important bit here, even for small cap investors, and I know I do get it in terms of regular updates and all this sort of stuff, but here, in this instance, I just think you need to take a slightly more patient view and look towards the sort of the light at the and the sort of the 2021, 2022. And don't get too caught up in the daily ramifications or the monthly ramifications and the swings in the share price and look at the big picture. Because the danger here is that small cap investors get so caught up in the micro detail, it shakes them out, that tree shake. And on that basis, you're going to lose out on a longer-term game. This has happened many times before. I mean, some of my stocks, for instance, as I mentioned before, small-cap microcap, have gone down sort of 50, 60%. And then 2, 3 years later, they've gone up like 3 or 4 times my original investment. So the important bit is don't lose sight of the bigger picture and what we're actually trying to do.
No, I agree with that completely. But I'm just thinking, Bob, if you're listening and you want the share price higher, just give me a regular update. Listen, I'll give a real example of this. If I was an investor in a non-listed company, right? Let's say I put a nice chunk of money in, say, a hairdresser's. A friend of mine asked for, say, investment, for example. I said, can you invest in my company? Hairdresser. I'd probably get an update from them, once a month at least. Probably more than that. So I think, and there's plenty going on. And the fact you say, I think the picture is improving. And I think that was probably the worst half they're going to have. For a long time.
Oh, I think absolutely. I
so,
mean,
So that would, the updates would be positive. And I think if you want to get the share price rallying, because it's and I always say this to companies, so there's 2,000 listed companies pretty much in the UK, and that they're all vying for investors' money. The small cap space obviously less there, but they're all vying for money. And the more you just repeat the story and then show it's evolving a little bit every time, the more chance that someone's going to invest with you if you've got a good story. Because that's all it is sometimes, is familiarity. And the more familiar you become with the investors, the more likely they are to invest, as long as that story is improving and you're undervalued and all that. And they can see there's a bigger picture there, it's going to work. But I think just communication a bit more often. And I just think the share price would be a lot higher now. There'd be a lot more buyers, and they would outweigh that seller. Or at least, the seller wouldn't be winning the game here. So that's why they just regular things. It's improving. We know that, but there's a lot of people who don't know that or can't tell if it is, so they won't invest. Yeah. So just come on, Bob, get out there. Just tell it. You're in contact. You're a major shareholder. Say, come on, Bob, get out there a bit more. Let's just chat a bit more. It won't hurt. Communication's good.
Just in that context, look at the connotations for the bigger picture. Where do we currently stand in terms of the actual markets? We've obviously had a massive run up, and I don't know if you've noticed, but the S&P 500 have hit an all-time high. Yep. Earlier on this week, and it's on about sort of 20-21 times 2021 earnings. Now, all I would say at the moment is that certainly my sentiment gauges, if you look at the fear and you look at the greed index indices, they're flashing complacency. Also, I had a quick look at the US options put and call ratio, and this is important as a flag just on current sentiment, because what it says is how many people are betting the market's going down compared to how many people are betting it's going up. And the put call ratio, if it goes down, indicates there's exuberance and there's lots of complacency, and it's hitting like 15-year highs at the moment. So all I would say is that there is a lot of fundamental reasons for the market to be up, and I'm with those fundamental reasons. And what I would say is that corporate profits have troughed, as we talked about in Q2. You've got stimulus measures from the bank, from all the central banks. You've got better outlooks on the on from corporates, and the bond markets are absolutely fine. You've had some, I think it was Ball Corporation, who make tin cans, who are in junk debt, who raised a huge amount of money at less than 3%. So we're all, the economy, there's lots of fundamental reasons to believe we're improving, and you've got lots of other sort of like measures like Help to Dine and all that kind of stuff. So it's all going in the right direction. However, short term, if you are one of these traders, or you are one of these people who have a shorter term view, then at the moment, it looks as though, on a contrarian bet, that we're going to get a bit of volatility heading into the autumn, particularly ahead of the US presidential elections, if the likes of Trump and Joe Biden start doing a bit of political, scaremongering or point scoring, and directing that at corporates to, say, increase tax rates or even put some extra controls on the technology, which the Democrats have done. So for me, it means I'm a long-term investor. I don't need to change my asset allocation, my stock selection. I'm absolutely fine. I'm going to ride out any sort of short-term volatility and noise. I've got a long-term time horizon. But if you're a more of a shorter-term trader and you're sort of like in and out the markets trying to predict sentiment-wise, I would say that on the balance of probability, if everybody is on the same side of the boat, that does tend to make it rather unstable.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I just recorded the weekend podcast because mates can't do it on tomorrow. And I did say, I think the market's about to have a little wobble here. Because, like I said, and I said a while back, I said people kept saying, why isn't the market selling off? It's ridiculous. When one of the biggest recessions, biggest unemployment levels. Firstly, a lot of people think it's going to be a V-shaped recovery. And of course, once we get a vaccine, a lot of people will go back to work. But you're still going to have damage. And it's not going to go back to full capacity for a long time, I don't believe. So I think we will reflect that sooner or later. And I said on the weekend podcast, have some cash. And I said, and I don't say that from a bearish sell everything and run for the hills kind of perspective. I say that because there's opportunity when you have cash. You'll be able to pick up, or even top up. If you've done good research on stocks you hold and you believe in them, why everyone's going looking for the next shiny new thing, you know, the next new company that's going to do a 10 by 20 bagger. No, hang on.
That sounds like you, Justin.
No, but what I'm saying is, I always do look for new companies, always. I mean, it's part of the thing, isn't it? You know, but every now and again we forget, and I forget. Hang on a sec. There's a couple of companies within my portfolio I'm not fully exposed to, or I'm quite happy putting a lot more cash into because I think the risk is quite low here, and that's why I say try and keep a bit of cash because I think we will see a bit of volatility. Talking about the fear and greed index, it's now at 72. It goes from 0 to 100, of course. The lowest I've seen it, actually, was one that dash for cash. It went down to 2. Turns out this is a contrarian index, of course. You should have been buying there at 2. And now it's at 72. You know, that's greed, it's called now. And like you say, when everyone's... And like I said before, I think we're going to have to get a lot more bullish before the market sells off. And now I think pretty much people are quite bullish, and people have just forgotten that there's going to be any kind of correction. They just think the Fed will step in, and all the bases are covered. Don't worry, it's all getting better. When we all have that mentality, that's when the market flips over, isn't it, really? You know, everyone's in.
I mean, another anecdotal bit of evidence as well is that this week we've had two very large and popular shares of companies have actually decided to split their stock. That's Tesla. Yeah. And Apple. And all they've done it basically is to juice their stock further. There's no economic reason. And now what you're getting is that many of the major merchant banks, to earn a few extra bucks for their fees, are suggesting lots of other companies with high share prices should do a stock split. And frankly, that is, there's no economics. People can already buy fractional shares on things, you know, Fidelity and Robinhood. So That's another bit of anecdotal evidence that we're sort of like clutching at straws to be able to try and juice the market higher. And I'm with you. If you're a betting man, if you're trying to throw the dice, you're probably sort of 60% likely that there's going to be a slight wobble. But the fundamentals are in place. We've reached the bottom. Don't lose sight of the bigger picture. But I'm with you, as in like keeping a bit of cash on the sidelines for opportunities. I would say in that context, and you mentioned topping up. I topped up 2 weeks ago when Lloyd's put its results. Remember when Lloyd's put its results on? We talked about it here, and I said, "In an R in all this sort of stuff." Well, I actually finally pulled the trigger. I thought, right, okay, this looks crazy because I looked through their provisioning for Q2, and frankly, most of it is just, you know, sort of like non-specific, generic economic assumptions. I mean, for instance, they took a £3.8 billion provision in the first half, 2.6 of which was non-specific. I wasn't tied to anything other than, you know, just economic assumptions. And a big chunk of that was along with the housing market expectations. And their assumptions that drove that provision is the housing market's going to go down by 6% this year. I just can't see that. You've got Halifax, you've got Nationwide, you've got Rightmove, all saying it actually went up in the last month and has gone on the year on year. So I thought, right, okay, well, this looks a good, you know, a good bargain. I'm going to buy. So I topped up. And then about a day later, the CFO bought 1 million shares. And
that's because he saw you. So Paul's buying. But guys, get in there. Paul's buying. He'll move the market.
And one of the non-execs bought 1 million shares. And the shares, the stock currently trades at 45% discount to net tangible book. So my thesis is that actually that will narrow in about 2 years' time. I wouldn't be surprised if I make 100% of my money because it will double.
Do you know what's funny? Do you know what's funny here is, you know, we can get as and investing can be as complex as you want to make it. You know, there's so many ratios and sort of indices and sort of figures you can look at. But when it comes down to it, I'm looking at the S&P right now, and like I said, it topped out right on 19th of Feb, and then a big fall off. 19th of Feb, what was it at? It closed at 3386. It's just hit that now the other day. And now when it comes down to it, the oldest adage, the oldest saying in the book, buy low, sell high. You know, that if you could have done that, and obviously it's all relative, but when we're now seeing the S&P at another high, pretty much hitting that high, of course, the probability is, do you really buy up here or just wait? Because, you know, it may roll over. And like I said, you are buying Lloyd's at an historical low, you know? It's like, at the end of the day, if you look at it, 2-3 year time horizon, of course you're going to do well. You know, it's almost a no-brainer. I hate saying that. I hate people who say that no-brainer, because nothing's a no-brainer when it comes to investing. But buy low, sell high. And we get confused, don't we? The emotions, we're caught up in that, the complexity. Humans want to complicate things. But simplicity wins all the time. It's like, you know, and you can, of course you're going to make money on Lloyds. He bought it at a very good price. Full stop.
Well, hey, I mean, you look at Warren Buffett. He's been loading the truck on Bank of America on the same principle out in the States. So
that's all he does, basically. I think Bob Warren just basically says, "Buy low, sell high." That's all he didn't do. I think that'd be honest. You know, before he dies, do you know what he said? A lot of people talk to me about cash flow models and all this stuff, but I pretty see, decent business, but buy low, sell high.
Simpsons. Another big stock that I haven't topped up, but I've actually bought a new position in. Is Taylor Wimpey, and I know I've been banging the table about UK house builders for some time, representing good value, but they did a placing, £510 million fundraise about 2 months ago or a month ago at £1.45. Since then, the shares have actually dropped to about £1.20, £1.18, and I've been tracking them, and I've been mentioning that I think there's good value in the whole of the sort of the UK house builders, and Barratt's and Taylor Wimpey are my preferred plays. Well, what was quite interesting is that, you know, they put their results out. The shares have dripped down, and I just thought, this is getting nuts. It's 1.1 times net tangible assets. And from the last trading statement, they were seeing increasing demand. The, say, Rightmove, Nationwide, the Halifax are all saying house prices are going up, which has got to be good for them. It's almost like the best of both worlds. They just raised a boatload of cash.
Didn't they say in the report, is there a report that we said they're saying house prices short term are going to get a bounce, but mid term they think they're going to drop?
Do you believe it, Justin? Look,
I don't know what I believe anymore. I mean, as far as reports and surveys are concerned, all surveys and reports are a bit nonsense. It's like, do you know what? The amount of economists that get it wrong, or I never see anything coming, I just think, and I see people saying, they've written this, there. So no, I don't really believe it, to be honest. But that's what they say, and I can't see it. I don't know. Depends, isn't it?
Just think, okay, right. What is a house? It's a physical asset, okay? What is a share? It is basically a paper asset but owns a share of a physical asset, i.e. a company, okay? We've already seen large asset appreciation in the stock market. There's no doubt, it's all-time highs, okay? Because we've got huge amounts of monetary stimulus, low interest rates, available, you know, some of the mortgage rates. We've got people of first-time buyers who have saved more, and we've got a lot of pent-up demand. What you're going to see later on in the year, asset price inflation. There's no way interest rates are going up, and you're going to see inflation. So you're going to get the second part of the asset, the physical home, land, which is going to increase. I cannot see house prices decreasing 6%, as Lloyds are saying. So that's my thesis. Now, what is also quite interesting, if you've actually been looking at the Hamptons International latest surveys, they do a survey of 700 estate agents around the country. One of the reasons for the actual house price increase is that there's a lot of very well-to-do people who live in the cities, particularly London, coming out into the home shires and buying larger houses with bigger gardens, wanting more space, and social distancing makes a lot of sense, but given we've just come through COVID, yeah? Mm-hmm. What do Taylor Wimpey do? The Wimpey part, and that's not derogatory, the Wimpey part does first-time buyers, starter homes. That should do very well, thank you very much, because people have actually been saving more. The old Taylor Woodrow side does expensive family homes, not your big sort of modern day blocks of flats out in. So they do these homes in the sticks, you know, 4, 5, 6 bedroom houses. So both of their parts of the business should motor. Hence, I bought a normal sort of position in Taylor Woodrow, because I think not only will house prices go up, the two areas that will be very resilient are exactly where they are. That's their sweet spot. And just two days later, the CFO buys a million shares at £1.20.
Paul's buying guys again.
Well, not a million shares. I think over £1 million worth, or £500,000 worth. And the chairman. So I think it's the CEO and the chairman both bought big as well. I mean, that just says to me, yes, there's going to be short-term volatility, but overall, Taylor Wimpey is in a very good spot in a market that people are being overly pessimistic on, I believe.
I think it'll revert to mean. Of course, people in Britain have always wanted to own a house. That's the way it is. There's very few people who don't want to own a house. I mean, it's the one big ask. It's what we all aspire to, isn't it? People want to own a... And I mean, again, just look at the chart. I'm looking the back now, Paul. Literally, I've got a chart here. And I'm scrolling back to 2014, pretty much. And the price you're buying at right now, of course, it dipped there on the sell-off in March. But it hasn't been down there since 2016. And then previous to that, there was a dip there. And then previous to that, 2014. So, of course, you're getting a good price. I can't see it doing badly here, you know?
Yeah, well, it's 1.1 times net tangible assets. Yeah. So it's basically what it's already got there. No value for its position and its land. And as I say, you've got best of both worlds. If house prices do actually fall off, it's got the cash to mop up some cheap land purchases, and if the market, as I believe, will continue to sort of like stabilize and strengthen rather than go down by 6%, which is all these economists have been saying, then it'll do well on its current land bank, which is like, you know, multi-years. So either way, I think you're going to be a winner. I'm not a greedy investor. If I make 50% in the next sort of 2 years, happy as Larry. And if they start talking about putting the dividend back in, then that'll be even better. You know, sort of like next year. Another stock that reported that I own, I've talked about, is Aviva, another value stock. I bought this about, I don't know, 3 months ago when the Remdesivir was surprisingly so successful at treating people with COVID, because I thought that was the watershed moment that we'd actually got we're going to get through the second wave. Now, Vivas, they did the same sort of thing. You know, they basically put out their numbers, and they were trying as much as possible not to put out really, really good numbers or, you know, to restore all their dividend, because they could do. They had the financial balance, but they didn't want to sort of like upset the regulator. So they did a sort of like we'll do an interim dividend of 6p. Well, that's brilliant, because the shares are trading at sort of like, you know, a discount to net assets. And it feels as though it can actually make payments now to shareholders. Their main assets, which is obviously, you know, corporate debt, which they buy, is doing fine. It's stabilised. As I talked about, you had Ball Corporation, which is high rate junk debt, but going for an all time low. There's no strains in the corporate debt market whatsoever. Their exposure to COVID in terms of insurance claims is pretty minuscule. So, I mean, I'm just sort of like firing up the numbers here and. On the life assurers, it's sort of like 290. I mean, they're trading at sort of like, you know, 6.7 times PE for this year and a sort of 5 times PE for next year and a sort of like 40% discount to net tangible assets. I mean, okay, they're not very exciting. But again, I think like Lloyds, you could be looking to do a 50 to 60 to 70% return in the next sort of like, you know, a year or 2 years. So, yes, you know, given my positioning in terms of long-term stock selection and asset allocation, even if we go through a wobble, which I expect over the autumn, I'm happy to hold these guys for 2 to 3 years. So yes, they might go down, who knows, but there's real value there, and they haven't yet sort of like enjoyed the bounce in the market that is particularly focused on the tech areas.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's look at smaller cap gains. You know what oddly happened in the week? I don't know why this comes from, and this happens now and again. When you don't expect it, a share price just jumps up, you know? And Roslyn Data, RDT, just jumped up in the week.
Justin.
Yeah, it jumped up by about 16-17%. I thought, well, why was that? It's come back a little bit since, but the volume was up, and there was no notification, anyway.
There was, Justin.
Oh, was there?
There was a big article in the Daily Mail.
Oh, yes, that's what it was. That's what it was. Sorry, someone did remind me. Yeah, it was an article saying pretty much what most investors who researched them knew anyway.
You own Roslyn, don't you?
Yeah.
Oh, so, good man. Yeah, sensible.
So I thought, listen, yeah, well, exactly. It's one of those. It's a sensible company that could do very well over the short term because, again, they've got a big chunk of cash raised at a premium, high recurring revenues, I'd say, in a very hot space, in a way people are outsourcing. So I think it's a very sensible company. It's like, you know, I thought sooner or later they'll release news, hopefully, move it, but that article moved it a little bit, but and it put it on the radar of people. But yeah, it was an article saying pretty much what we've talked about, isn't it? And
You own it and I own it. I mean, we're both on the same page. We believe in the story, and who knows where this will be, but this has got a much larger upside envelope than my large caps of Aviva and Lloyds. I mean, I think there's no reason to believe over the next 2 to 3 years, if things go to plan, this can't be a sort of like, you know, 15p, 20p, 25p share compared to, you know, 5 or 6p now, if things move in the right direction, because they'll be then not only, you know, generating more earnings and a higher turnover, but the rating will appreciate significantly from only 1.5 or what, slightly higher now, isn't it? It's sort of like 1.8 probably, given the shares have moved up to 6p. But I mean, you've got a significant upside in the re-rating and on the actual power of the engine on the sales. So yes, the upside there is very, very significant, and it would be justified on fundamentals alone, never mind technical side.
Yeah, yeah. What other small stocks? Are you on Elicosoft? Anything else? Any other small stocks you own?
Northbridge. Northbridge came out with a trading update, and it was pretty good. I mean, there was no doubt about it. I mean, given we've just been through COVID again, the worst of the just as a reminder for people, it has two divisions. One of it is Crestrick Load Banks, which is a world leader in what it does, and effectively helps stabilize the network and any generators which are off grid. But it allows them to be commissioned and tested and services, and that's seeing significant, you know, demand from numerous things, but largely from renewables, from wind and solar, battery farms, also from data centers, even from one of the Nightingale hospitals it's helped commission all the electrics for. So that's doing well. It's got a record manufacturing order book. It's been impacted again by difficulties of getting into customer sites because of COVID. And then the much smaller, which is only about sort of like 5% of EBITDA, is the Tasman oil business out in Southeast Asia or Australia. And that hasn't actually done too badly either. It's going to take a longer timeline for the recovery to work. But 75% of that is geothermal and natural gas exploration rather than oil. But as I say, again, it's been hit by difficulties for international workers being able to travel across, you know, country boundaries to be able to get to the actual sites. But that will all come back. And so a bit like Clearstar, it'll have its low in Q2, Q3 will be better than Q2, Q4 will be better than Q3, and the market actually see it really doing well in 2021, particularly if we have a vaccine. And it would have done, I'm absolutely convinced, really well in 2020 if it hadn't have been for COVID. It was really motoring in Q1 of 2020. So I'm very optimistic on that. And you know, my price target, shares are currently trading at about 19.95p. I mean, my price target, well, I wouldn't say a price target, my fair value for it is about 180, and that's not unreasonable. So, you know, I'm there. The only difficulty is it's fairly illiquid stock, but there's some smart investors in there. You've got Gresham House Strategic in there, it's a good, you know, it seems a good, solid business.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so what are you looking for now? I mean, you've got some cash, like you say. Are you just looking to top up maybe on opportunities or looking for new stocks or what?
Yeah, I'm largely now looking for new stocks, and I'll just be patient. And if anything gets any good quality business that gets sold off harshly, then you know, I'll look to buy in. I mean, you know, the ones.
Anyway, it's big cap, small cap. Anyway,
no, I'll be mainly small cap now. I think I've got enough on my big cap in terms of Taylor Wimpey, Aviva, and Lloyds. I mean, the stocks that I, you know, really all would love to buy. Okay. At a better discount, yeah. My top five would be.
Don't tell anyone then. So we'll tell you next week.
I'll tell people what I mean. The things to watch, yeah, which I'm watching like a hawk. If a Elicosoft or a Lico now it's called ever drops, I'll buy some more Lico. Tristel, obviously, what a top business that is. Healthcare, Inspiration Healthcare, I'd buy a lot more of that. Not a lot more. I haven't got any shares of that one. On the market, I quite like, actually. I think On the Market is good, albeit I might be getting slightly, would be slightly getting heavier on the house building side. So, you know, anything like that. Blanco, I would definitely want to buy a lot of if that ever came down on any bad news. Interseed Group as well. Wow, that is a marvelous business. I'd definitely, you know, jump into that one without any hesitation at all. InStem's another good business. So lots and lots of good tech. The areas that I'm really focusing on are healthcare, which I haven't got enough exposure on, and I would like more in the software at the right prices, you know, software as a service and recurring revenue streams.
Yeah, absolutely.
What about you, Justin? Where are you looking?
No, I'm not really. I'm happy now. Do you know what? Honestly, I'm trying to...
How much cash have you got?
I got about 35%, 36%.
Okay. You and I are on the same page then. I'm on about 35% now, having done the purchases, yeah?
And it's just having patience, you know. I say I've got eyes and stuff, and some of them, like, sort of liquid, so... I like that On the Market. I mean, I didn't jump in when it was at low, really, because I do like that space, but
another opportunity.
Yeah, no, I think, no, it's always, isn't, that's the thing, the market, isn't it? The market always presents opportunities, and I think if we have weakness generally in the market, then there's a couple of, I'll get my shopping basket out, but it's just me having patience, you know. I find it hard not to sit, in fact, I've had a bit of cash for a while, but I find it harder not to be active and just buy or top up, as yet, I've not really done a lot. I'm just sitting and waiting, because I'm thinking, we've had this rally, a lot of people are now bullish, and that to me says, uh-oh, there's going to be a sell-off. We're at the top of the market in the S&P, like I say, there's going to be a sell-off. So I'm just waiting. And let the opportunities come to me, and that's what Austin said. I don't know who it was, one of the, you know, that book, Market Wizards. Maybe it was Buffett again, I don't know who it was, but they said, let the market come to you, you know, do your research, let the market come to you, and then just pick it up when at a cheap price, you know.
There are two very good expressions from Warren Buffett, which every investor, you and I included, should always remember, particularly when we're feeling impatient, yeah, is that firstly, you haven't got to swing for every ball. Wait for the right balls to go for, okay? That's the baseball sort of like analogy. And the second one is, the most important trait of successful investing is, what do you reckon, Justin?
Discipline.
Yes, pretty good, actually. Patience. Patience.
Yeah.
And so if you can wait it out and not be sort of on that buy or sell button constantly, you'll see longer term gains, which is much harder than it actually sounds.
That's the thing. I mean, that I keep saying that book and go back to it, and literally, you know, the difference between people who've done, you know, earned a bagger or two baggers, or, you know, and the ones that have actually achieved 100 baggers is basically they've had more patience. And that's it. Now, they both, you know, everyone buys at the right time, pretty much. A lot of people have, but then they just got bored with it. And I think, well, hang on a sec. If I just held on for the 6 years, you know, I could have seen my money, you know, 10, 20 fold of my money, rather than just having to look around with that shiny new thing. When actually, what you've got in your portfolio sometimes is the thing you found. It's there, you know. So, but just time needs to cook.
And one thing I would say, just on language, and I know it's a good bit of terminology and people like it and stuff, but if you use the word bagger a lot, okay, it tends to imply that you're quite an impulsive, you know, guy naturally. Mm. And all I would say is that people who are fixated on bagging then are probably going to be always keen to hit the button on buys and sells.
No, I don't see that. I think it's bagging. What I say about that is an easy way of saying, okay, double, trebling, whatever. I mean, it's an easy way of saying that. I mean, I don't imply that as time. What I'm saying is, if you want baggers, you know, and you buy a good company and you wait, and that's it, you know, and buy a good price, good level, good value, and wait, that's it. And, you know, it's a lot harder, like I say. It's a lot harder saying, I don't know, someone said to me recently, where do you see this share price being when they release this news? And I said, I have no idea. But I get a better chance of it being a lot higher in 2 years' time than it is now. And so that's it, isn't it? If you look at the chance over the next 2 years, the probability of it being higher, if it's generating real value and it's undervalued now, is a lot higher. I can't tell you it's going to be next week. You know, you can have a bomb drop somewhere in some country and everyone gets shaken up, or whatever. You can't tell. You know, that's the day to day.
I'll give you another sporting analogy, okay?
Yeah.
Cricket. the most successful batters are the ones that, you know, in the top three or four, and they get ones and twos, okay? Yeah. They basically block the ball, run between the wickets, and get the centuries.
Boring, though.
The guys who come in, the sluggers, hit the occasional six, are usually getting out for less than 10 or 20 or 30 because they get caught, okay? So if you have a balanced view in terms of not aiming for the bagging all the time, if a bagging comes along, then they're all fine and dandy, you hit a few sixes. But aim a bit closer to your skill set and go for the ones and twos. You'll hit more centuries than you will than the guy who just comes in and goes for the slugfest.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, yeah, no, I think bags are a bad thing, a bad terminology. If, like I said, when I'm looking for companies now, I literally look for a line of sight from this value to that value. How much is that? You know, how much is it? Okay, I can see why this would be multiples of its original, of this initial value. That's what I mean by bagging. But you've always got to see, because sometimes people suggest stocks, and well, hang on, look at the market, look at the demand there. Is the demand big enough? You know, is it a proven market? So I see a lot of people, you know, I like tech. And one of the qualifying filters I have when I'm looking for companies is not only is the market hot, but is the demand there? And there's lots of companies come out with a great invention, a good bit of tech, and it sounds good, but there's two proofs of concept. Does it work? Yes, it does. Is there a demand? Is there a market for it? Sometimes there's not. And it doesn't matter how good the tech is. If there's no demand for it, the market isn't growing, they're not going to do very well. They may have a short run-up in the share price, but it won't be sustainable, you know, so that's one of the things you look for. I think I always look for a line of sight between, you know, the value generation that can happen in a company, you know, and...
I think you're spot on there, yeah. I mean, GARP investing is what I do, and I'm totally on you. If the company's got good sort of technology, good IPR, defendable position in a growing market, I mean, you're there. That will cover most evils. If they slip up, then frankly, longer term, it isn't going to make any difference. They're still going to do well.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff. Have a nice weekend, Paul, and we'll speak you next week.
Yep.
Short. Yep.
We had 2 weeks of material there, didn't we?
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Mitre Pharma, up 40% to 45 pence. MTPH ticker there. At four, Avaca Bio. OVB is ticker up 32%, 17.5 pence. At three, N4 Pharma, up 8.14% to 11.63 pence. At two, Iconic Labs, up 37.5% to 0.0138 pence. And at one, Supply at Me Capital, up 32%. To 0.3 pence. Top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Arix Bioscience, notice of results. At four, Bahamas Petroleum, operational and corporate update. At three, Europa Metals, updated resource estimate. At two, Extract Resources, Bushranger Copper Gold, progress update. And at one, Deltic Energy, that's a P2252 update. 3D seismic processing. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
CODA salutes those who've served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.